The Ego and His Own, The Case of the Individual Against Authority, by Max Stirner. Translated from the German by Stephen T. Byington. Edited with annotations and an introduction by James J. Martin. This unabridged recording of the reading of The Ego and His Own was produced in 1994 by Laissez-Faire Audio, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Laissez-Faire Audio. This book is 366 pages long and is divided into two parts and five chapters. The Ego and His Own, The Case of the Individual Against Authority, by Max Stirner. The following material appears on the book's dust jacket. This is the first edition of Max Stirner's universally known libertarian classic to appear in English in 45 years. In fact, the first in any language to come forth since the end of the First World War. A world poisoned by decades of totalitarian war has begun to review the origins of the anthill society, which has turned out to be the real logical consequence of the herd forces launched by the French Revolution, with its nationalism, majority group tyranny and conscription, and of Marxian and other coercive collectivisms, including the 20th century state capitalist forms. Part of that reappraisal has resulted in the rediscovery of Marx's formidable contemporary opponent, Stirner, and the complacent feeling of Marxians that the former had disposed of Stirner for all time has been badly shaken. As Herbert Reed observed in an essay commemorating the centennial of Stirner's The Ego and His Own, the German original, Der Einzige und sein Eigentum, bore the publication date 1845, though it really was in circulation in the last months of the year previous. The giants whom Marx thought he had slain show signs of coming to life again, and Stirner is one of them. The fact that Stirner was the real antithesis of Marx, and incidentally of Hegel, has long been ignored, blurred, or suppressed, though Sidney Hook, in his durable From Hegel to Marx, emphasized that in their controversy, Marx and Stirner were discussing the fundamental problems of any possible system of ethics or public morality. How a number of lesser figures have been posed as Marx's prime antagonists over the years is a tribute to the determination to escape the far more uncomfortable and demanding Stirnerite alternative. James L. Walker, in his introduction to the original English language edition in 1907, declared that, "In Stirner, we have the philosophical foundation for political liberty." This is amply borne out by Stirner's point-blank repudiation of all isms and dogmas, his tireless restatement of the necessity for self-liberation, for refusal to become mobilized and immolated by the juggernaut of church or state or the society of the secular mythmakers. Stirner shows that men can make their own tyrants as they make their own gods, Walker observes, and his purpose is to unmake tyrants. Comment on Max Stirner's The Ego and His Own. Today, when the philosophical and political problem of the individual and the problem of morality are more urgent than ever, Max Stirner's book, The Ego and His Own, continues to present a serious challenge. Read in the light of Nietzsche and of contemporary existentialists, it is in many ways even more significant than when it first appeared in 1844. Political scientists and philosophers, as well as the ordinary thoughtful reader, whether moved to agreement or disagreement, cannot fail to be stimulated by it. Roy Finch, Professor of Philosophy, Sarah Lawrence College. The Ego and His Own is the most formidable assault on authoritarianism ever launched. Nothing distracts Stirner from his pursuit of the exposition of freedom for everyone, not just for himself. No one has surpassed Stirner in dealing with these two aspects: individualism, whence it stems, and where its logic goes. Dr. James J. Martin. Dedication. To my sweetheart, Marie Dainhart. Editor's Introduction. 50 years sooner or later can make little difference in the case of a book so revolutionary as this. This was the opening sentence of James L. Walker's introduction to the first English-language issuance of Max Stirner's Der Einzige und sein Eigentum by Benjamin R. Tucker in 1907. It is probably as succinct and concise a summarization of the significance of the book as has ever been uttered. But Walker has not been the only one to speak of Stirner in this manner. 2 years later, James Huneker, in his famous evaluation, referred to the book as the most revolutionary ever written. He has left behind him a veritable breviary of destruction, a striking and dangerous book, Huneker declared. It is dangerous in every sense of the word, to socialism, to politicians, to hypocrisy. There is little doubt that The Ego and His Own is one of the most formidable assaults on authoritarianism ever launched. It may even belong in the first position as such. It is at once a historical document, a pamphlet of the intellectual disturbance of the mid-19th century, and a timeless classic. Its persistent reappearance in one language or another in the last 100 years testifies to the latter. However, the attention to Stirner has not been smooth and steady, but rather irregular and spasmodic. Its appearance in English for the first time was a product of one of these surges of interest, largely ignited by the great impact of Friedrich Nietzsche, especially between 1885 and 1910. As a consequence, Stirner was attached to the tail of Nietzsche's comet as a precursor, though he had been a comet in his own right before Nietzsche had even been old enough to learn to walk. The only biography of Stirner is John Henry Mackay, Max Stirner, Sein Leben und sein Werke, Berlin, 1898. It has not been translated into English. It remains the only significant source on Stirner. Paul Lauterbach, in his introduction to the 1892 Reclam edition of Der Einzige, thought it was ironic that Stirner dedicated his book to his second wife, Marie Dehnhardt, whose education, background, and interests hardly suggested she was capable of grasping more than a very scant portion of it. Lauterbach recalled the old Spanish saying, "Da Dios almendras al que no tiene muelas." God gives almonds to him who has no teeth. It is not of prime significance that Max Stirner's life be stressed here, though a few items of substance may be mentioned. He was born Johann Kaspar Schmidt in Bayreuth, Germany, on October 25, 1806. The name he adopted as a pseudonym was originally a nickname from student days, a reference to his broad, high forehead. His career prior to the writing of his first and major book was obscure, though it included education in 3 universities and 6 years' experience in teaching. His first wife died in childbirth in 1838, and he remarried in 1843, which also appears to be the date when he began to draw together his thoughts and material into the book which was to shock and outrage a goodly portion of intellectual Germany the year after, and subsequently the whole Western world. From internal evidence, it appears that he completed Der Einzige sometime in February or March 1844. A rather expert job of book production followed, for although the book bore the date 1845, it was actually in the hands of readers in November 1844. The Leipzig house of Otto Wiegand issued it in an octavo volume of about 500 pages. Stirner's book came out at a stormy time in Western and Central European affairs. France, Italy, and the whole German world were in furious distress caused by the pressure of liberalism upon the monarchical structure of politics in these lands, clamoring for a voice in the making of public policy and the running of affairs. And in the background and the underground boiled the propaganda of socialism, supervised by a score or more expert tenders of mainly French and German origin. The philosophical proponents of the powerful national secular state had also made their appearance, and the polished thought of Johann Gottlieb Fichte and Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, in particular the latter, had made a deep impression on the thinkers of the whole political spectrum of the time. In a way, Stirner was both a product and a victim of these factors. His book came out of them, and it was buried in the avalanche of the revolutions of March 1848 and thereafter. But in the interval between its publication and the uprising of the 48ers, a lively intellectual conflict spread. Few books have aroused such hostility and general disparagement as Stirner's, though it was not the author's intent to avoid a battle by any means. His spirited polemics against the principal figures among the so-called left Hegelians, the Jung Hegelianer, particularly Ludwig Feuerbach and Bruno Bauer, invited reprisal, let alone his equally rousing tilt with the socialists, especially Wilhelm Weitling and Moses Hess. Stirner represented a third force in these agitated times, neither a defender of the theological or monarchical state, nor a protagonist of the secular models advanced by the liberals and socialists. His views were as shocking and repellent to the latter as to the former. And Stirner went into almost total eclipse in the following 40 years, while the modern secular state took shape, with its distinctive homogenization of the new nationalism and socialism, and the surviving but mutated strains of the earlier divine right and ecclesiastical authority, plus the ingredients consisting of the enfranchised and compulsorily armed masses which the French Revolution contributed. Stirner's principal intellectual and social company had been the Berliners of Hegelian inspiration and tendencies, whom he had encountered at Hippel's restaurant, who were known as Die Freien in some circles. These bold spirits included Ludwig Buhl, C.F. Köppen, Arthur Müller, and the brothers Bruno, Edgar, and Egbert Bauer. And there were others. It was assumed Stirner was one of them, and the largest part of the critics in the subsequent half-century generally lumped him in the Hegelian left. But Stirner's book is the anti-Hegel, as Victor Basch elaborated nearly 60 years ago. And in an important sense, a thorough reading and understanding of Hegel is necessary to understand Stirner. The assault on the master was not an explicit one, however. Hegel is mentioned sparingly, though significantly, in a direct sense. It is through his younger exponents that Stirner propels his critique of their state and its related personifications and generalized ideas. It was in the company of these persons that such previews of Stirner as exist made their appearance. He published a few articles in the Hallische Jahrbücher and the Deutsche Jahrbücher, ephemeral journals edited by Arnold Ruge in the years just previous. They were largely ignored at the time and not made generally available for over half a century. It is in these that the germs of his anti-Hegelian revolt are first discerned. The history of Der Einzige und sein Eigentum is worthy of a glance. After its first appearance, it sank out of sight for nearly four decades. The original publishing house of Wiegand brought out a second edition in 1882 and a third in 1901. These latter two were separated chronologically by the 1892 Universal Bibliothek edition of Philipp Reclam, Jr., also of Leipzig, in the famous Miniatur Ausgaben series, which found Stirner in the company of world-famous literature. The publication of a full-scale biography of Stirner by John Henry Mackay in 1893 preceded two translations in French, which were published one after the other in Paris in 1900 under the title L'Unique et sa propriété. These set the stage for the English translation and publication. The first American to dwell at length on Stirner was James L. Walker, a Texas newspaper man and later physician, and an associate of Tucker. Walker brought Stirner's egoism into the pages of Tucker's world-famous anarchist weekly Liberty with increasing frequency during the 1890s, and himself prepared a strongly Stirner-influenced book, The Philosophy of Egoism, published posthumously, Walker having died in Mexico in 1904. His introduction to the Tucker edition of Stirner was written in 1902 or 1903, evidence that Tucker planned to release the book in that time, though some unknown circumstance delayed its issuance. In a publishing career which went back to 1875, Tucker insisted that making Stirner available in English was his most important contribution in the entire time. After Tucker's property was burned out in the fire of January 1908, his work ended. But apparently the plates of this book were salvaged, because editions in the identical format with that of 1907 came out in London and New York in 1913 through 1915 under different auspices, and a third by still another publisher was produced in New York in 1918. The history of Stirner's book in languages other than those examined above is obscure. There were Italian and Russian translations, and possibly in a Scandinavian language, as Stirner was very familiar to Henrik Ibsen and the Danish critic Georg Brandes, the latter having written at some length on Stirnerism. Huneker declared that the translation by the erudite philologist Stephen T. Byington was admirable, which is indeed a fact. He was aided in his work by Walker and by Emma Heller Schumm and George Schumm, all expert in German. So, in one sense, it was a cooperative project. Byington did the greater part of the work, however. His preface to the original edition is preserved here in order to illuminate some of the difficulties encountered in Stirner's frequently diffuse style, and his etymological references are preserved throughout the book in the original footnotes. His choice of the English title, The Ego and His Own, is specially felicitous. Friedrich Nietzsche was a few months old when Stirner's book was published, but no other thinker has been compared more to Stirner than Nietzsche, and perhaps with less evidence for it. A critical controversy raged among philosophers and academic people over this issue, in particular between 1890 and the First World War, and a literature of large enough scope exists on this subject alone to warrant a substantial book. Albert Levy, in his careful study Stirner et Nietzsche, points out that Stirner is not mentioned in either the works or the correspondence of Nietzsche at any time, and with the exception of a single instance, Nietzsche appears not to have been aware of him at all. In the case of every writer who has tried to establish such relationship, the method has consisted of dependence on inference and the coincidental similarities, which can be established by superficial content analysis. This is the approach of a considerable number of oversimplifiers, of whom Paul Karas is one of the best examples. Stirner was an uncommonly keen student of classical antiquity, the French Revolution, and the Bible in particular. The latter is his most quoted source by a wide margin. In one sense, this appears incomprehensible, considering Stirner's position on religion. Of this, more will be said shortly. An attempt has been made to annotate as many of Stirner's literary references and allusions as seems practicable, in view of their number and his careless documentation. The latter, in particular, suggests the contemporary polemic part of his book. The sources are thrown about carelessly like so much spare lumber, and the overall impression conveyed is that his readers are fully aware of their nature or have read them. The Ego and His Own is a piece of fierce writing, in an icy, relentless, epigrammatic style, as Huneker describes it. Nothing distracts Stirner from his pursuit of the exposition of freedom. He is for freedom for everyone, not just himself, and he is consistent in not shrinking from the consequences of this pursuit. It may very well be that the largest number of mid-20th century individualists does not have the stamina to stick with Stirner to the bitter logical end. The various libertarians are free to decamp at that point of the journey beyond where they no longer care to proceed. But it is their responsibility to know whence individualism stems and where its logic goes. No one has surpassed Stirner in dealing with these two aspects of the problem. There are uncanny portions of this work. One might cite in particular his discussion of the semantics of freedom and compare them with the similar dissertations by George Orwell in 1984 and Eugen Zamyatin in We, those most exquisitely anti-Stirner worlds. Stirner, in a sense, was a pioneer in the area of general semantics. Stirner wanted all to be free. He was not arguing just for himself or for a special segment of mankind. But he stressed over and over the part the one desirous of freedom had to play. Freedom was not something someone else gave you. All freedom is essentially self-liberation, says Stirner. His concern is with the individual rebel, not the revolution. It is as such that he respected Jesus, a rebel who concerned himself not a whit with the politics and the state of his time. But for organized Christianity, and for all other organized religions, Stirner had particularly harsh words. Personal insurrection, rather than general revolution, was his message. He recognized the futility of meeting the authorities at street barricades with broom handles at a time when the Romantics were still enamored with this concept. The age of automatic arms and instantaneous communication was just around the corner. The general revolution brought either socialism or a tyrant, in his view. The revolutionist merely exchanged masters, often for the worse. There are only 5 chapters in Stirner, 3 very short ones, separated by 2 very long ones. And it is in the latter that he has packed the very largest part of his message. Though he assaults religion, philosophy, morals, every source of inspiration for authority, As for his principal target, Victor Bash remarks, L'État, voilà le grand ennemi, voilà l'éternel tyran du moi. All authority materials end up as arms and nutriment for the state. And Hegel and his chief disciples were the agents of his time who appeared to be doing the most thorough job of preparing the world for the new secular Leviathan. Stirner was scornful of the German national unity fervor of the 1840s. He was almost completely untouched by one of the most uproarious political fermentations in the history of Central Europe. In his view, unity would just be the superimposing of a far more grim and ferocious monster for the existing 38 separate weaker ones of the existing states. He saw no net gain in replacing the ecclesiastic or monarchical state with the new secular product in the making. In fact, he was sure that the latter had immeasurably superior means and capabilities for oppressiveness. But if Stirner was appalled by the Hegelians, he was equally appalled by the communists. The ego and his own was a pitiless attack on communism well before the Communist Manifesto was published. And it is at the same time one of the most original and unanswerable critiques of coercive collectivism. A social associate of Friedrich Engels, published in one of the journals edited by Karl Marx, Stirner's socialist antagonists were Weitling and Hesse, and the French propounders of the same ideology, all more prominent at that moment. Stirner saw clearly through the communist appeals of the 1840s, the seedbed of the manifesto, in particular the talk of the necessity of eliminating the state. He reiterated that communism would produce instead a state far more onerous than the royal, ecclesiastic, or bourgeois models communists fulminated against so tirelessly. Yet Stirner does not talk of future societies or blueprints for them himself. For the most part, he avoids all soothsaying. The structure of the free union is beyond his ken, and he felt it was a futile field for prediction in the first place. As he says in one place of the slave, and the speculations as to his likely behavior once his servitude is ended, one cannot know what he will do until he actually gets free. The century coinciding roughly with the end of the Second World War may be described ideologically as the Age of Marx, during which Marxism was presumed to be victorious over Stirner and all other antagonists. The fact that Marx devoted such an immense part of his ponderous Die Deutsche Ideologie to an attack on Stirner was conceded to be the principal prima facie evidence of the former's triumph. A generation ago, Sidney Hook, in two widely acclaimed books, calmly reaffirmed that Marx demolished Der Einzige und sein Eigentum, it being nothing but a social defense mechanism of a petty bourgeois soul. Marxists long tended to display this cavalier attitude toward Stirner, generally without reading a line of his work. In fact, Marxist literary and intellectual influence for a time all but brought about Stirner's consignment to the memory hole of 1984 fame. But there is plentiful evidence that he, Proudhon, Bakunin, and the others against whom Marx tilted never lost their validity during this period. The last two decades in particular have seen the repeated reappearance of their works in various forms. As Herbert Reed declared in his masterful essay commemorating the centennial of Stirner's book, after a sleep of 100 years, the giants whom Marx thought he had slain show signs of coming to life again, and indeed they have returned. Marx's criticism of Stirner, Reed advanced in a famous second thought, would need drastic revision to be convincing today. As for critics of Stirnerite egoism such as Berdyaev, Reed was of the view that Stirner could have handled him capably with a single sentence. Concerning Stirner's examination of love and his consistent plea in behalf of the integration of personality, Reed concludes with several impressive observations. He finds many modern views in such areas as held by Erich Fromm, Jung, Martin Buber, and even the existentialists in very close rapport with, if not dependent on, Max Stirner. The fashionable day for ad hominem attacks on Stirner seems past. The ego and his own has demonstrated survival value. It deserves to be read in the same spirit and in the same way one reads The Prince. James J. Martin, Malibu, California, September 8, 1962. Translator's Preface. If the style of this book is found unattractive, it will show that I have done my work ill and not represented the author truly. But if it is found odd, I beg that I may not bear all the blame. I have simply tried to reproduce the author's own mixture of colloquialisms and technicalities, and his preference for the precise expression of his thought rather than the word conventionally expected. One especial feature of the style, however, gives the reason why this preface should exist. It is characteristic of Stirner's writing that the thread of thought is carried on largely by the repetition of the same word in a modified form or sense. That connection of ideas which has guided popular instinct in the formation of words is made to suggest the line of thought which the writer wishes to follow. If this echoing of words is missed, the bearing of the statements on each other is in a measure lost, and where the ideas are very new, one cannot afford to throw away any help in following their connection. Therefore, where a useful echo, and there are few useless ones in the book, could not be reproduced in English, I have generally called attention to it in a note. My notes are distinguished from the author's by being enclosed in parentheses. One or two such coincidences of language, occurring in words which are prominent throughout the book, should be borne constantly in mind as a sort of carry perpetuum. For instance, the identity in the original of the words spirit and mind, and of the phrases supreme being and highest essence. In such cases, I have repeated the note where it seemed that such repetition might be absolutely necessary, but have trusted the reader to carry it in his head where a failure of his memory would not be ruinous or likely. For the same reason, that is, in order not to miss any indication of the drift of the thought, I have followed the original in the very liberal use of italics, and in the occasional eccentric use of a punctuation mark, as I might not have done in translating a work of a different nature. I have set my face as a flint against the temptation to add notes that were not part of the translation. There is no telling how much I might have enlarged the book if I had put a note at every sentence which deserved to have its truth brought out by fuller elucidation, or even at every one which I thought needed correction. It might have been within my province, if I had been able, to explain all the allusions to contemporary events, but I doubt whether anyone could do that properly without having access to the files of three or four well-chosen German newspapers of Stirner's time. The allusions are clear enough, without names and dates, to give a vivid picture of certain aspects of German life then. The tone of some of them is explained by the fact that the book was published under censorship. I have usually preferred, for the sake of the connection, to translate biblical quotations somewhat as they stand in the German, rather than conform them altogether to the English Bible. I am sometimes quite as near the original Greek as if I had followed the current translation. Where German books are referred to, the pages cited are those of the German editions, even when, usually because of some allusions in the text, the titles of the books are translated. Stephen T. Byington. The Ego and His Own. All things are nothing to me. What is not supposed to be my concern? First and foremost, the good cause, then God's cause, the cause of mankind, of truth, of freedom, of humanity, of justice. Further, the cause of my people, my prince, my fatherland. Finally, even the cause of mind and a thousand other causes. Only my cause is never to be my concern. Shame on the egoist who thinks only of himself. Let us look and see, then, how they manage their concerns, they for whose cause we are to labor, devote ourselves, and grow enthusiastic. You have much profound information to give about God, and have, for thousands of years, searched the depths of the Godhead and looked into its heart, so that you can doubtless tell us how God himself attends to God's cause, which we are called to serve. And you do not conceal the Lord's doings either. Now, what is his cause? Has he, as is demanded of us, made an alien cause, the cause of truth or love, his own? You are shocked by this misunderstanding, and you instruct us that God's cause is indeed the cause of truth and love, but that this cause cannot be called alien to him, because God is himself truth and love. You are shocked by the assumption that God could be like us poor worms in furthering an alien cause as his own. Should God take up the cause of truth if he were not himself truth? He cares only for his cause. but because he is all in all, therefore all is his cause. But we are not all in all, and our cause is altogether little and contemptible. Therefore we must serve a higher cause. Now it is clear God cares only for what is his, busies himself only with himself, thinks only of himself, and has only himself before his eyes. Woe to all that is not well-pleasing to him! He serves no higher person, and satisfies only himself. His cause is a purely egoistic cause. How is it with mankind, whose cause we are to make our own? Is its cause that of another, and does mankind serve a higher cause? No. Mankind looks only at itself. Mankind will promote the interests of mankind only. Mankind is its own cause. That it may develop, it causes nations and individuals to wear themselves out in its service, and when they have accomplished what mankind needs, it throws them on the dung heap of history in gratitude. Is not mankind's cause a purely egoistic cause? I have no need to take up each thing that wants to throw its cause on us and show that it is occupied only with itself, not with us, only with its good, not with ours. Look at the rest for yourselves. Do truth, freedom, humanity, justice desire anything else than that you grow enthusiastic and serve them? They all have an admirable time of it when they receive zealous homage. Just observe the nation that is defended by devoted patriots. The patriots fall in bloody battle or in the fight with hunger and want. What does the nation care for that? By the manure of their corpses, the nation comes to its bloom. The individuals have died for the great cause of the nation, and the nation sends some words of thanks after them, and has the profit of it. I call that a paying kind of egoism. But only look at that Sultan who cares so lovingly for his people. Is he not pure unselfishness itself? And does he not hourly sacrifice himself for his people? Oh yes, for his people. Just try it. Show yourself not as his, but as your own. For breaking away from his egoism, you will take a trip to jail. The Sultan has set his cause on nothing but himself. He is to himself all in all. He is to himself the only one, and tolerates nobody who would dare not to be one of his people. And will you not learn by these brilliant examples that the egoist gets on best? I, for my part, take a lesson from them, and propose, instead of further unselfishly serving those great egoists, rather to be the egoist myself. God and mankind have concerned themselves for nothing but themselves. Let me, then, likewise, concern myself for myself, who am equally with God, the nothing of all others, who am my all, who am the only one. If God, if mankind, as you affirm, have substance enough in themselves to be all in all to themselves, then I feel that I shall still less lack that, and that I shall have no complaint to make of my emptiness. I am not nothing in the sense of emptiness, but I am the creative nothing, the nothing out of which I myself as creator create everything. Away, then, with every concern that is not altogether my concern. You think at least the good cause must be my concern? What's good? What's bad? Why, I myself am my concern, and I am neither good nor bad, neither has meaning for me. The divine is God's concern, the human, man's. My concern is neither the divine nor the human, not the true, good, just, free, etc., but solely what is mine. And it is not a general one, but is unique, as I am unique. Nothing is more to me than myself. Part First, Man. Man is to man the supreme being, says Feuerbach. Man has just been discovered, says Bruno Bauer. Then let us take a more careful look at this supreme being and this new discovery. Chapter 1. A Human Life. From the moment when he catches sight of the light of the world, a man seeks to find out himself and get hold of himself out of its confusion, in which he, with everything else, is tossed about in motley mixture. But everything that comes in contact with the child defends itself in turn against his attacks and asserts its own persistence. Accordingly, because each thing cares for itself and at the same time comes into constant collision with other things, the combat of self-assertion is unavoidable. Victory or defeat? Between the two alternatives, the fate of the combat wavers. The victor becomes the lord, the vanquished one, the subject. The former exercises supremacy and rights of supremacy. The latter fulfills in awe and deference the duties of a subject. But both remain enemies and always lie in wait. They watch for each other's weaknesses. Children for those of their parents, and parents for those of their children, their fear, for example. Either the stick conquers the man, or the man conquers the stick. In childhood, liberation takes the direction of trying to get to the bottom of things, to get at what is back of things. Therefore, we spy out the weak points of everybody, for which, it is well known, children have a sure instinct. Therefore, we like to smash things, like to rummage through hidden corners, pry after what is covered up or out of the way, and try what we can do with everything. When we once get at what is back of the things, we know we are safe. When we have got at the fact that the rod is too weak against our obduracy, then we no longer fear it, have outgrown it. Back of the rod, mightier than it, stands our obduracy, our obdurate courage. By degrees, we get at what is back of everything that was mysterious and uncanny to us, the mysteriously dreaded might of the rod, the father's stern look, etc. And back of all, we find our ataraxia, our imperturbability, intrepidity, our counterforces, our odds of strength, our invincibility. Before that which formerly inspired in us fear and deference, we no longer retreat shyly, but take courage. Back of everything, we find our courage, our superiority. Back of the sharp command of parents and authorities stands, after all, our courageous choice, or our outwitting shrewdness. And the more we feel ourselves, the smaller appears that which before seemed invincible. And what is our trickery, shrewdness, courage, obduracy? What else but mind? Through a considerable time, we are spared a fight that is so exhausting later, the fight against reason. The fairest part of childhood passes without the necessity of coming to blows with reason. We care nothing at all about it, do not meddle with it, admit no reason. We are not to be persuaded to anything by conviction, and are deaf to good arguments and principles. On the other hand, coaxing, punishment, and the like are hard for us to resist. This stern life-and-death combat with reason enters later and begins a new phase. In childhood, we scamper about without racking our brains much. Mind is the name of the first self-discovery, the first undeification of the divine, that is, of the uncanny, the spooks, the powers above. Our fresh feeling of youth, this feeling of self, now defers to nothing. The world is discredited, for we are above it, we are mind. Now, for the first time, we see that hitherto we have not looked at the world intelligently at all, but only stared at it. We exercise the beginnings of our strength on natural powers. We defer to parents as a natural power. Later, we say, father and mother are to be forsaken, all natural power to be counted as riven, they are vanquished. For the rational, the intellectual man, there is no family as a natural power. A renunciation of parents, brothers, etc., makes its appearance. If these are born again as intellectual, rational powers, they are no longer at all what they were before. And not only parents, but men in general are conquered by the young man. They are no hindrance to him, and are no longer regarded, for now, he says, one must obey God rather than men. From this high standpoint, everything earthly recedes into contemptible remoteness, for the standpoint is the heavenly. The attitude is now altogether reversed. The youth takes up an intellectual position, while the boy, who did not yet feel himself as mind, grew up on mindless learning. The former does not try to get hold of things, for instance, to get into his head the data of history, but of the thoughts that lie hidden in things, and so, therefore, of the spirit of history. On the other hand, the boy understands connections, no doubt, but not ideas, the spirit. Therefore, he strings together whatever can be learned, without proceeding a priori and theoretically, without looking for ideas. As in childhood, one had to overcome the resistance of the laws of the world, so now, in everything that he proposes, he is met by an objection of the mind, of reason, of his own conscience. That is unreasonable, unchristian, unpatriotic, and the like, cries conscience to us, and frightens us away from it. Not the might of the avenging Eumenides, not Poseidon's wrath, not God, far as he sees the hidden, not the Father's rod of punishment do we fear, but conscience. We run after our thoughts now, and follow their commands, just as before we followed parental, human ones. Our course of action is determined by our thoughts, ideas, conceptions, faith, as it is in childhood by the commands of our parents. For all that, we were already thinking when we were children, only our thoughts were not fleshless, abstract, absolute, that is, nothing but thoughts, a heaven in themselves, a pure world of thought, logical thoughts. On the contrary, they had been only thoughts that we had about a thing. We thought of the thing so or so. Thus we may have thought, God made the world that we see there. But we did not think of, search, the depths of the Godhead itself. We may have thought, that is the truth about the matter. But we do not think of truth itself, nor unite into one sentence, God is truth. The depths of the Godhead who is truth, we did not touch. Over such purely logical, theological questions, what is truth, Pilate does not stop, though he does not therefore hesitate to ascertain in an individual case what truth there is in the thing, whether the thing is true. Any thought bound to a thing is not yet nothing but a thought, absolute thought. To bring to light the pure thought, or to be of its party, is the delight of youth, and all the shapes of light in the world of thought, like truth, freedom, humanity, man, illumine and inspire the youthful soul. But when the spirit is recognized as the essential thing, it still makes a difference whether the spirit is poor or rich, and therefore one seeks to become rich in spirit. The spirit wants to spread out so as to found its empire, an empire that is not of this world, the world just conquered. Thus, then, it longs to become all in all to itself. For although I am spirit, I am not yet perfected spirit, and must first seek the complete spirit. But with that, I, who had just now found myself as spirit, lose myself again at once, bowing before the complete spirit as one not my own, but supernal, and feeling my emptiness. Spirit is the essential point for everything, to be sure. But then is every spirit the right spirit? The right and true spirit is the ideal of spirit, the Holy Spirit. It is not my or your spirit, but just an ideal supernal one. It is God. God is spirit. And this supernal Father in heaven gives it to those that pray to him. The man is distinguished from the youth by the fact that he takes the world as it is, instead of everywhere fancying it amiss and wanting to improve it, model it after his ideal. In him, the view that one must deal with the world according to his interest, not according to his ideals, becomes confirmed. So long as one knows himself only as spirit, and feels that all the value of his existence consists in being spirit, it becomes easy for the youth to give his life, the bodily life, for a nothing, or for the silliest point of honor. So long it is only thoughts that one has, ideas that he hopes to be able to realize some day when he has found a sphere of action. Thus one has meanwhile only ideals, unexecuted ideas or thoughts. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.